Welcome to Inside Voices, a well-read magazine between the pages podcast. I'm host Robert Gwaltney.
And I'm host Jeffrey Dale Lofton. We have today with us Rashid Newsome. He is an author, he's a television drama writer, an executive producer, a showrunner, and My Government Means to Kill Me is his debut novel. It was a 2023 Lambda Literary Finalist for Gay Fiction, and was also named one of the 100 notable books of 2022 by the New York Times. Rashid, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here. I'm looking forward to this.
And we're glad you're here as well. So I showed the cover of your book. Let's start there. What was the concept for the cover of your novel, My Government Means to Kill Me? In fact, that profile, the archway, the rainbow colors. Tell us about it.
Well, there was a big discussion about what how gay or how black the book cover should be. I mean, there's a world where you can take that title, My Government Means to Kill Me, and you can just put it over a New York cityscape, sort of let readers sort of discover what it is. But I mean, one of the things I loved was that it was sort of unabashedly sort of awashed in Black history and gay history. So we sort of all agreed, like, let's just let this book announce what it is from across the room. This is one of those cases where we wanted people to be able to accurately judge a book by its cover. And so that meant taking a Black man, because there's a Black man at the center of the story, putting him on the cover and letting people know that this was going to be just gay, gay, gay. And I just found it beautiful. I know some people see like two or three rounds of covers before they select it. I remember where I was when I saw this cover. I was in Philadelphia. We were filming the pilot for Bel Air, and it came in at like 6 in the morning before I went downstairs to like start the day for the crew call. And I looked at it and I was happy. I remember I cried. I called my editor, Naji Nieto at Flatiron, and I said, this is it. This is the cover.
Wow. I guess you had a good day.
That was the highlight of the day. We were shooting that day on the street in Philadelphia. And that was, most of the people in Philadelphia were completely unimpressed by there being a television crew there and proceeded to walk through our shots with reckless abandon.
Well, I love the cover, you know, and the title is compelling. What's people's reaction been to both the cover and the title in general?
Well, the title is interesting because I'll tell people, they if I'm around or if it comes up, I've written a book and I say it's My Government Means to Kill Me. The title sort of cuts across ideology and generation. Like, no, almost everybody agrees with the sentiment that the government might indeed mean to kill them, right, left, or center. Where you find more division is when you look at the cover. And I don't know. I mean, I think people might look at the cover and say, this book is not for me. But I do think if you have that inclination, don't buy the book. I mean, I think you have to come to this book wanting to step into this world. I'm not trying to begrudgingly drag anyone into this story.
Absolutely. You know, and Jeffrey and I have had this conversation before. I mean, there is no one book that is for everyone. Now, I was giggling a little to myself when you were saying, is it too gay? Is it too black? Thinking, well, what is too gay? What might that look like?
Well, I think in literary fiction, it comes down to sort of the depictions of sex, which sort of sometimes get sort of tamed or cut out of the book altogether. And I think it also goes, how deep into the rabbit hole of sensibility are we going to dive here? You know, I've got a reference to Brenda Fraser, and you've got to be a Sondheim nut or of a certain age to kind of have that reference play. But I wanted all of that in there. I didn't want to hold back anything.
Well, you know, that kind of brings up something that Robert and I have been talking about is the footnotes. So, you know, Fraser, that's a very specific reference, and not everybody will know who she is. Tell us about the footnotes in the book. I mean, it's a work of fiction, but there are footnotes in this book.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, the book presents itself as a memoir. You know, this is the memoir of Trey talking about his early years in New York City in the mid-80s. And he's a gay young Black man who is stepping into that time at the dawn of the AIDS crisis. I wanted to give to that memoir feel a sense of authenticity. And one way to do that, and it's a simple little trick, was to add footnotes. Because when we read something with footnotes, it feels more official. You know, it just seemed, we all used to write book reports, and you'd put those footnotes in here or there that sort of give some heft to the work. But I also did it because I was being very true to how I thought the characters would talk. And there's a shorthand when you're part of any inside group. So Black people have it, gay people have it. And I didn't want to interrupt that shorthand between the characters by stopping to sort of teach a class to people who may not know some of these references. So the footnotes became a way of saying, if you know, if you get it, you can just sort of keep reading. You don't even have to look down at the bottom of the page. But if you don't know who Larry Kramer is, or if you don't know who Bull Connor is, that's there for you. I also like the footnotes because it sort of gave the book this running history through queer pop culture and political movements that was hopefully giving a wider context to the book.
And yeah. You've really expanded upon this idea of the footnotes in your social media presence. How have you done that? Why have you done that? What gave the idea of a sort of jumping off the page literally into the Instagram sphere, the TikTok sphere?
I've been very lucky. My husband works in documentary and reality TV and is very adept at sort of, you know, editing and finding footage that speaks to some of these footnotes and brings them to life. I mean, I think if anybody out there, if you have a book coming out and you're publishing it, one of the things you have to figure out is, how do I keep this story alive or keep mentioning the book without just repeating myself and saying, buy the book, people eventually tune that out. If you can sort of take your book and dive deeper into it and show people parts of history, that's been great. So, you know, we have footnotes on Little Richard, we have footnotes on Bayard Rustin, and my husband was able to sort of find that footage and chop it up. I've been very lucky. I think the TikToks and the Instagram have worked and certainly gotten us a lot of some sales that wouldn't have otherwise materialized. I have younger friends who tease that my husband and I are the oldest people they know who actually know how to use TikTok correctly. So that I'm as proud of that as the Lambda Lit nomination.
That's awesome. You know, we were talking, Jeffrey mentioned earlier about the footnotes and this memoir feel to the book. So I'd like to back up for a second and talk a little bit about the heart of your book, Young Trey. Talk a little bit about him and how he came to be.
How he came to be is I wrote another novel that failed to sell. And it was about a multi-generational family in Indianapolis. And Trey was a member of that family and then left to go to New York when he was 17. That book went all around. I mean, did the rounds, went to dozens and dozens of editors. No one wanted it. No one bought it. And I was devastated. But then, you know, you can't help yourself. You start thinking, well, what am I going to do next? And Trey sort of emerged because I thought, well, I already know all about his early life. I know him inside and out. And I know his voice. I looked at what was happening when he landed in New York and I said, that's an interesting time. I could write that. And I wanted to try to capture in Trey what it's like to not only be gay and Black, but specifically to be young and to be moving into an era when history is really happening and you get to decide where you're going to jump in.
So what parts of Trey do you most relate to? Of course, aside from the obvious, you're a young Black gay male. But from what perspective, we will say that you're young. You're much younger than Jeffrey and I think.
Oh. Sorry, Jeffrey thinks of me more as a contemporary.
Yes, absolutely. So talk a little bit about Trey and where you see eye to eye on him, just aside from those two very obvious things.
Well, what Trey and I shared was I grew up in Indiana, and I knew from a very early age, if I'm going to be me in full, I've got to move away as soon as possible. So I went to college with the idea of like, okay, now we can step into who we are meant to be more fully. And the other thing I share with Trey was blinding optimism. Like I really did think things would work out for me, even if I couldn't see how they were going to work out for me. I'm a big soap opera fan. I love my daytime dramas. And so I thought I was Susan Lucci. I thought I was Erica Slezak. I thought I was Elizabeth Hubbard. I thought I couldn't be thrown off the show. So I really didn't. I thought, well, no matter how bad things are for me on Friday, it's going to work out on Monday. So we have that going. The other thing we have, which I have outgrown, is a real wariness and distrust of adults. I found myself, when I was young, almost saying, well, don't tell me how you think the world's going to work. Someone's going to have to show that to me. Someone's going to have to prove that to me. I'm not taking anyone's word for it. And Trey's got that, which, you know, can make him a bit challenging as a person. But, you know, that kind of the arrogance of youth also makes a lot of great things kind of come into creation. So I didn't want to lose that either.
So what took that distrust away? Was it what changed as you grew up yourself?
I think I learned that people are more honest with other adults than they are with children. When you are an adult, people turn to you and they say things like, I'm really scared, or I don't know how this is going to work, or I think I made a mistake. And for whatever reason, we don't like saying those things to children. We don't want to worry them. We have to pretend that we always know the way, even when we are lost in the woods together. And so as you get older and people begin to level with you, I mean, we probably all have that feeling of the older relative who finally gives us the real story about something that went down in our past. I mean, like they've had one or two drinks at the family reunion and now we're going to hear it. Well, they weren't going to tell you that when you were 10, but they might tell you when you're 30.
And now so, you can write about it.
And then you can write about it. Then you can dig. Now you've got the material you need. I've got kids of my own, and it's a fine line to walk where you don't, of course, want to scare the hell out of them about, you know, everything that could go wrong in the world. But I think what changed is as I became an adult, I was able to see through some of the lies that people told more easily, and people were willing to level with you in a way that they wouldn't when I was younger.
You began to talk about your children. And I'm fascinated with, you know, there was a time, and Jeffrey and I have talked about this as well. Of course, the plane is flying for me. I think I'm a little too old to have children at this point. But there was a point in my life where certainly I thought about it. And I certainly had this romanticized idea of what I thought being a father might be like. What has surprised you most about fatherhood?
What has surprised me most is probably the fact that you have an awesome sort of power at your fingertips, and you can see that if you don't sort of handle some key moments right, you could warp the perception or sort of reshape this child in a way that you really have to be careful of. There are, in my own life, I can think of some times when maybe adults just sort of casually answered something, not realizing what it meant to me, not understanding what the implications of that answer meant to me. So I'm trying always to remind myself that I don't get to choose what they remember from this childhood. You do have to sort of be on your mark, even when you're tired. And that surprised me. It's the human psyche, these little people that you've been given, incredibly delicate. Now, what is fun is some of the programming you can just do. Like when it comes to music, you get to literally indoctrinate this person into all the music you love. And as far as they know, the music you love is the best music in the world. You know, they grow up learning all the words to that. That part is fun. Making sure you don't sort of cut into their curiosity or their braveness just because you're afraid. So I've got a son who's 6 and he loves climbing things. Everything. And he's really good at it. And I both have to figure out how high do I let him climb, but also I don't want him to be hurt. And when do I say, I think you need to get down from there because I'm afraid. So that's been the bigger surprise.
You don't want to be that Kelly Clarkson song where she sings about her mom, right? Not letting her get too far from the sidewalk.
Yes. Yes. And yet, there, it, like, you kind of, I mean, you're watching it and you're going, if this boy falls, we're going to the hospital, you know? And so you kind of, I mean, so we do this thing where you're almost there trying to just like Well, if he falls, can I catch him from here? Can I guess I could catch him.
Robert, you mentioned writing songs written about you, but I guess also you can have novels written about you too. So I guess you get a chance, in addition to indoctrinating them to your music, to the literature you loved as well.
Oh, yes. All the stories, all the things. I mean, you are there. You're giving them their cultural touchstone when it comes to literature, fashion, I mean, all of it. And, you know, we try to be thoughtful about it. But it also is just a lot of fun. I mean, that my children know who Patti LuPone is a point of pride with me. And I'm not sure any of their friends do, you know, but they do.
I love that. Patti LuPone. Yeah, I don't know. There are not a lot of 6-year-old children that know Patti LuPone.
There's a song Patti LuPone does called Got a Lot of Living to Do. And she's like, to do. And my son, when he was like 2 years old, would just go hit that to do part with her every time we played it in the car. And I just thought it was the cutest thing. And I loved it. And they still know that song.
Do you have any recordings of that?
one thing about these kids, and we'll find out how it turns out. I don't know. I mean, like, when I go back for pictures of me as a child, there may be a couple dozen a year. These kids have been photographed every day of their lives. Every day of their lives, photographed, videotaped. I mean, they could come put it together and have a human reconstruction of their entire lives.
Amazing.
Well, that's great. You know, and well, it's good and bad. You know, I see photographs of myself when I was going through very awkward stages, and they're cringeworthy. But so, talk a little bit about, you know, being a father, being a husband, being a writer of not only of television and of course novels. How do you balance all of that?
I mean, I didn't do them all at once. Like, I sort of, it's almost like you're spinning plates. You just put one on at a time and see how it goes. You know, the relationship with Jonathan came first. I was with him, and then I broke into television. And then we had the children as I sort of moved up the ladder with my writing partner, TJ Brady. And then the book was the last piece. And the book's been interesting. I did not know the year was going to be the way the year has been. In that I wrote the book, a lot of it during the pandemic, so television wasn't really happening. And then when it began to come out, I thought, well, they'll need me for a month or maybe two to promote the book. And then I will go back to my television life. That it has led to one thing for another for more than a year is delightful, but a complete surprise, and would have probably been overwhelming had you told me that. I also, heaven help me, just as the pandemic opened this space where I could be more literary, the writer's strike has now created another space where the writer's strike was going, and I didn't necessarily have plans to do a little book tour when the paperback came out in August, but suddenly I found myself quite free. And so you go, well, let's go back out on the road. I can do this.
I mean, because this has been a several month journey with this strike, and not just you, but there's so many.
I mean, we've shut down the entertainment industry. The scripted entertainment industry is at a standstill. So that is all the names that scroll at the end of a television show or movie. Every single one of them is out of work right now. And it's devastating, and it's hard. And I'm afraid to say, don't hold a lot of hope in my heart that an end is imminent. I think right now everybody's trying to prepare themselves psychologically and financially for the idea that this strike could reach into next year.
Wow. What do people like us, just the general public, what do you want us to know? When we see you on the picket line, we hear, you know, spokespeople, but what would you want just the general, you know, walking down the street person who's not involved in the industry, what do you want them to know?
Well, what I want them to know is that most of the people who you see, those names scrolling at the end of the show, are not rich the way people might imagine. You know, you might know a half dozen television writers or producers that you can name, and those are pretty much the only ones who are wealthy. The rest of us are working gig to gig. And we don't mind that. Like, that's not news. It's not unusual for us to be out of work 3 months, 6 months between an assignment. What what we're protesting for is the math and the way we're paid no longer adds up in a way that we can sustain ourselves, that most of us can sustain ourselves financially. 15 years ago, when I was on Lie to Me, which was a broadcast show, I would write a script and the script fee was 40 something thousand dollars. Now, when I write a script for a streaming company, we're splitting like $25,000.
Wow.
And that's 15 years later. And the residuals off of that haven't been great, even when the show is wildly successful. We are in this strike because the entire model is at such a stance, at such a point that we don't know that most of our members can like scrape a living together. It is a desperate situation we find ourselves in.
What's caused the shift? You know, once where you could write a script for 40,000 and then diminish almost by half, is it because of the amount of content?
It's because of streaming. Okay. So what has happened is you used to do something on network or even pay cable. Like when I was on Lifetime writing Army Wives is a good one. I would write a script. They would rerun it that night. So I'd get my $40,000 script fee. And I would know because they reran it that night that 3 months from that date, I would get another $40,000. And then if they ran it a few more times, I would get $20,000 and it would go down by half. But what was great is I could budget off of my work. I could say, well, I know I'm getting this here and I'll get this later. And you had a rough idea. There was a formula you could keep in your head and you could manage your life off of it. Now, because of streaming, the formula is so complicated and we also don't get to see the numbers. We have to just trust that they're giving us what they are supposed to be giving us. We are unable to sort of manage our affairs or know what we're going to get. I've written scripts and then not gotten paid off and streaming for 2 years before you finally go, hey, where's my money? I've gotten scripts sort of, you know, the checks got very small very quickly, and I don't know why, because the show was seen all around the world. So we're trying to get more transparency at those numbers and a formula we can understand. It's funny, those of us who work in television, it's not like we are asking them to make this some sort of secure job for life. We absolutely understand the risk inherent in doing this work. But as it's playing now, it just doesn't add up and it doesn't make sense. I worked on Narcos, which was a huge show for Netflix. Some of the worst residuals I've ever gotten in my life. The size of the audience seems to has no implication on the size of the script I'm getting. And that shouldn't be the case. I tell people all the time when I talk to other authors, could you imagine if you wrote a book and they wouldn't tell you how many copies you sold?
Yeah.
Well, I've been on shows where they wouldn't tell us how many viewers had watched the show.
That's astonishing. Thank you for being honest and sharing that. I couldn't quite fully understand the scope of what you and others were up against. So thank you for talking a little bit about that with us.
I'm happy to do it.
And I have a sort of a related question. You know, it's about the personal impact. You know, it's so we see people on the picket line. I spent half a day
on
the picket line with you several months ago, but that was, you know, everyone was upbeat and happy, and that was several months ago, but in reality they're out of work.
Yeah.
And that's essentially their job, to say, you know, listen to us, talk to us, negotiate with us. How is everybody doing? How are they making it through? Especially,
it's rough. I mean, I think we are united in the sense that everybody understands why we're doing this and why we have to have this fight. We have to press these issues with the studio. That part everyone gets. The toll it takes on everyone's household is another story. And it's very rough. And there are people being swept out of the business. There are people who are going to lose their homes. There are people who are going to harm themselves. Lives will be lost during this. And that is very upsetting and horrifying to me. I think in some quarters of the studios, this is looked at as some sort of business dispute, and keeping us out there on the strike and not negotiating with us in good faith is a business tactic. It is changing lives. It is changing the nature of television and movies in this country and around the world. who will be able to survive the strike, who will tell the stories once the strike ends. That is all being shaped, and it's devastating.
Well, thank you for being such an articulate spokesperson for your fellow artists.
Absolutely. I mean, I do hope that this will come to a close favorably for you and all of your friends. Yeah, I'm just so sorry that you're having to experience this.
It's once in a lifetime. I will say I'm someone who did not believe there would be a strike. I thought if there was going to be a strike, it would end within a matter of weeks. I thought when the actors joined us on strike, that would draw it to a close quickly. I thought we'd be done by Labor Day at the latest. And so I've had to retire my crystal ball, and I'm just now preparing myself for the longer haul.
So, as we're getting close to the conclusion of our conversation, circling back around to Trey in your wonderful debut novel, there's this sense of sort of a search, right? And a search for meaning. Right now, with where you are in life, what would you say that Rasheem knows to be true?
What do I know to be true? I think I know that no matter what the cost, it is better to be yourself. It's easier to get through life when you don't have to pretend to be someone else every moment of the day. So I think being authentic helps. I'm much more willing to let people see my flaws as I grow older than I was when I was younger, and I felt I had to be perfect and put off some sort of perfect image. I know my talent to be true. I see in Hollywood, certainly, a lot of people who have mastered the idea of the image, the persona. And then I've been working with them behind the scenes, and I go, oh, wait, oh, you don't actually know how to do this. Oh, my goodness. And it made me feel like very grateful for the fact of like, oh, well, I actually, no matter what happens, I know how to do this. I'm good at this. I have a talent, and it's going to stay with me for a very, very long time. So those are the things I probably know to be true.
Well, we wish you every success. We hope that the strike comes to an end very quickly for you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Inside Voices.
Robert Jeffrey, thank you for having me. This has been great.
So, gentle listeners, until next time, I'm Robert Gwaltney.
And I'm Jeffrey Dale Lofton. And remember, to be creative is to be courageous.